Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. This year's U.S. presidential election is now less than 2 months away, but is a foreign government working to determine whether Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump take office? The Clinton campaign and much of the mainstream media, including the Washington Post, would like you to think so. With frequent allegations being hurled against Russia by the Democratic establishment, do any of the accusations actually add up? Are Americans losing faith in the political system because of the machinations of Moscow? Or is that discontent actually entirely homegrown? Today, we will spend the full hour addressing the election and the so-called Russia threat. We are joined from New York by journalist and writer Ben Norton. He is a politics reporter and staff writer at Salon.com. We are also joined from Moscow by Clinton Ehrlich, a visiting researcher at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, and by Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and now political activist and journalist. Welcome, Ben, Clinton, and Ray.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for joining us. Ben Norton, let's start with you. Let's start with an example to remind our listeners of the type of absurdity that we're dealing with. A few days ago, the Washington Post ran an article with the headline, "The Man Who Discovered CTE," that's the concussions in football, "Thinks Hillary Clinton May Have Been Poisoned." And then the guy, Bennett Omalu, uses a misspelled tweet to confirm, in fact, that he must advise the Clinton administration that, in fact, Hillary Clinton may be being poisoned by the Russians. I mean, it really is getting out of control. Talk about it, Ben.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the editorial standards have completely broken down. I mean, they weren't very high in the first place when it comes to U.S. enemies. But in this campaign, really what is being published is in many ways risible. I mean, it really does elicit laughs. And, you know, this is just one of a slew of what are, I mean, let's be honest, conspiracy theories. The U.S. media frequently berates people who criticize U.S. foreign policy, who criticize, you know, neo-colonialist kind of policies throughout the world. But then, you know, now they give free rein to people to just spread pretty obscene, baseless conspiracies. And, you know, you mentioned this particular case, which, you know, is kind of the cherry on top. But there are a variety of similar cases of unsubstantiated claims published in the Post and elsewhere. I mean, you know, I got up a few examples because I've written about this pretty extensively in the past several weeks. And, you know, I'll just go through really quickly. But another article published by the Post in early September called U.S. Investigating Potential Covert Plan to Disrupt November Elections says, it quotes an anonymous U.S. official. And then it says in the piece, quote, "The official cautioned that the intelligence community is not saying it has definite proof of such tampering or any Russian plans to do so, but even the hint of something impacting the security of our election system would be of significant concern," the anonymous official said. You know, so there are many different lines. You can go down the list of other examples. When the New York Times published a piece in July that kind of first started these baseless allegations called "DNC Hack Raises a Frightening Question, What's Next?" And, you know, there are a lot of, I wouldn't say errors, but there are a lot of questionable allegations in it without any kind of substantiation. But the, you know, best part of this article is in the second last paragraph of this 20-paragraph piece, it mentions that the Clinton campaign, which accuses Russia of hacking its computer system, has no evidence for its claims. So we're seeing actually a situation I would say is comparable in many ways to what happened in the scare during the rise to the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, which was illegal, was against the UN Charter. Kofi Annan, the Secretary General at the time, said it. But the lies that were sold in the U.S. media were critical to justify this illegal war. And if you look at the kind of style of reporting done then, it's full of anonymous sources of U.S. government officials. So, you know, they won't be on the record for the future as having lied to the press. You know, it's full of all these weasel words like alleged, believed, supposed, And then there's, it's all of these implications. It's like you just pointed to, you know, this absurd implication. Even though we can't prove it, we can imply that somehow Clinton was poisoned by Russia or some obscene claim. And, I mean, it's, as a journalist, it's really a shame to see colleagues just resorting to these base rank propaganda measures.
Clinton Ehrlich, you just heard Ben Norton talk about the propaganda, the kind of journalism that's being used is very reminiscent of what took place just before the Iraq War, the run-up to the March 19, 2003 shock and awe invasion and then occupation of Iraq. You recently wrote an article in Foreign Policy where you said why, I can't remember the exact title of the, but it was something like why the Kremlin really fears a war with the United States as a consequence of Hillary Clinton's political orientation or policy. Do you agree with Ben Norton that it's like the run-up to the Iraq War?
I do agree with Ben Norton with the qualification that I think this is significantly worse than the Iraq War. And the reason for that is twofold. The first reason is that before the Iraq War, there was at least a coherent narrative, and there was some evidence. In hindsight, it was fabricated evidence, except at the time, they could point to things that externally looked legitimate. At this point, they simply don't have that, you know, in terms of accusing the Kremlin of meddling in our election. The evidence to this point has been the FBI's accusation that voter databases in two states were penetrated by hackers from Russia. Well, there's plenty of hackers in Russia who aren't associated with the Kremlin. More fundamentally, those databases and those voter rolls are something that can be purchased. And so it would be of absolutely no use to Russia in trying to rig an election. And moreover, the second point would be that the stakes are so high here that obviously the Iraq War was a disaster, except people don't seem to understand the gravity of the accusation that's being made. Ann Applebaum, in her recent piece in the Washington Post, essentially accused Russia of currently, right now, orchestrating an effort to rig the U.S. election and said, why would Russia not do that? Well, the reason Russia wouldn't do it is deterrence. This would be worse than an assassination attempt on the president of the United States. And the reason for that is that if you assassinate the president, you don't control which party is in power. The reason that an assassination is serious isn't because a person dies. It's because it's a strategic attack on the power structure of a state. And when you talk about rigging a presidential election, you're not just talking about eliminating an individual. You're talking about fundamentally taking control of a country. And that kind of strategic attack, if it were ever discovered, would essentially create the pretext for a war with Russia. And instead of a conflict with Iraq, which has claimed tons of lives and trillions of dollars, we could be looking at a conflict with a state that has more nuclear weapons than any other. And when we deal with that kind of existential risk, it just shocks me how reckless supposed experts are being.
Ray McGovern, you are a former CIA analyst. You were a specialist on the Soviet Union. You were a presidential briefer. The article that Clinton mentioned in the Washington Post by Ann Applebaum is entitled How Russia Could Spark a U.S. Electoral Disaster. And then she goes through all the different scenarios for how that would actually happen. I want to read one of them. Point number four, the Russians attempt to throw the election. They might try to get Trump elected. Alternatively, and this would, of course, be even more devastating, they might try to rig the election for Clinton, perhaps leaving a trail of evidence designed to connect the rigging operation to Clinton's campaign. This is a serious journalist in a major article in The Washington Post. You have been writing about this a lot. I know that at RayMcGovern.com, at the Consortium News, you guys are talking a lot about, yes, this is propaganda, this is demagoguery, this is hyperbole, this is crazy, but it also has possibly very, very serious consequences. Talk about that.
Well, Brian, I don't usually disagree with you, but I don't agree that Ann Applebaum is a serious journalist. She's in the model of Judy Miller. She's not to be taken seriously. What we have here, in very plain words, is the mother of all conspiracies. The notion that Russia is interfering with our election, which, as Ben pointed out, there is no evidence about, which the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, not known for his clarity or his veracity, has said both things. He said, please, the business about Russia being involved in trying to dethrone or trying to prevent Hillary from becoming president, people are hyperventilating. Hyperventilating. That's James Clapper's word. And then in the next sentence, he says, but, you know, the Russians do this kind of thing. The Russians do this. So the thing is monstrous, and it, you know, if it weren't so important, it would be ludicrous. Here's the core of it. Someone leaked to Julian Assange very sensitive emails from Hillary Clinton and from the Democratic National Committee. Leaked, not hacked, leaked. My friends who are former members of the NSA believe that there's a second Ed Snowden there that gave Julian Assange these emails because he or she was horrified that Bernie Sanders was clearly cheated out of his rightful access to the nomination. It's clear. It's clear as can be in the emails themselves. Now, Julian Assange massaged them very carefully, not changing a word to keep them pristine pure, but he delivered them 3 days before the Democratic National Committee, National Convention. Now, big problem. I can just see Hillary Clinton's Council of War. What are we going to do about this? Somebody said, well, I know. We'll blame the Russians. We'll blame Putin. That will be a twofer. We'll get Putin and we'll get... And then somebody said, yeah, but it wasn't the Russians. It was Assange. Well, that's okay. We'll say that Assange is a Russian stooge. We'll give that to the mainstream media and they'll run with it. And it works. It works like a charm. Now, one last thing I'll just say here is that this is all on the premise that Vladimir Putin and the Russian leaders would prefer to see Donald Trump as president. That gives me gastric pain. This is a guy who brags about his penchant toward being unpredictable. Now, you're Vladimir Putin. You're sitting in the Kremlin. You want somebody who is unpredictable, who goes into a rage at the slightest slight, even real or imagined? You want that person to have the nuclear codes? You know, I think Vladimir Putin looks at the situation in our country and says, you know, there may have been a lesser evil in earlier elections. There ain't none now. Hang tight, batten down the hatches.
Ben Norton, Ray McGovern has obviously tapped into something that's very real, because the release by WikiLeaks right before the Democratic National Convention was so compellingly clear that the Democratic National Convention leadership and committee leadership had violated its own rules, trying to tilt the election in the direction of Hillary Clinton. Deborah Wasserman Schultz had to step down. She was immediately that same day given a new high appointment in the Clinton administration.
30 minutes later.
But they were able to change the subject. They said, well, it's not about our cheating. It's not about rigging the election. It's not about stealing it from Bernie Sanders, as Sanders and his supporters were alleging. It's really about the Russians, the evil Russians. Okay, that's an understandable but narrow agenda. I'm wondering if there's a bigger agenda that's playing out, and we have about 3 minutes before we go to our first break. Is there a bigger agenda that has to do with the neoconservative foreign policy orientation that is perhaps locking in following the Obama administration and has already started during the Obama administration, that actually is targeting Russia, not for narrow electoral or opportunist purposes, but in a bigger picture? Talk about that.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with the basic premise of that. And to preface that point, I think it's also important to recognize that, as the fellow guests had previously articulated, I mean, this larger media framing is ridiculous and it goes deep. But the whole idea that Russian government hackers hacked the DNC in order to undermine Clinton's campaign is contradicted by some of the other claims that the Clinton campaign and media outlets have made. I mean, their own argument is undermined by other things they've said. So, for instance, they blamed the DNC hack in which Trump opposition research was leaked also on Russian hackers. So which is it? Are Russian, ostensible Russian hackers hacking the DNC to undermine Clinton, but then also trying to make Trump look bad. It's a ridiculous argument, and I agree with McGovern. I mean, I think Russia is looking at the situation and saying, well, you know, neither of these leaders will be a good fit for us. I mean, and either way, you know, you'll have Trump, who is unpredictable and who sometimes flirts with anti-interventionist policies, but then the next day he'll call for the most extreme form of military intervention. And then you have Clinton, who, as you just said, Brian, has an extremely hawkish orientation with, you know, she's certainly a neoconservative, but I think in many ways neoconservative is euphemistic. I mean, she's an imperialist. She believes in the strength of American power. You know, Max Boot, one of the leading neocons who endorsed her for president very publicly in a kind of hyperbolic op-ed talking about her, you know, foreign policy accolades. Max Boot is another leading neocon, but he doesn't call himself a neocon. He literally calls himself an American imperialist. He says that we need to bring back the I word, as he put it. So, I mean, yes, I think it's absolutely right to say that, you know, if you look at it from Russia's perspective or Iran's perspective or Cuba's perspective or any of these countries that are, you know, being targeted by the U.S. and have been for decades, people are terrified of the prospect of a potential Clinton presidency. I mean, this is someone who has never seen a war she didn't support. And, you know, this has been a consistent policy for decades. It's not just one or two policies. She supported the wars, the NATO wars in Yugoslavia, you know, in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 90s. She supported the Iraq war very enthusiastically. And not only did she vote for it, she spread baseless rumors about how supposedly al-Qaeda was linked to Saddam Hussein, which is ridiculous. Anyone who knew anything about Saddam Hussein knew he, you know, he was a repressive ruler, but he was not tied to al-Qaeda. He was repressing al-Qaeda viciously in his own country and any kind of extremist Salafi elements. And since then, you know, she played a leading role in the NATO bombing of Libya, which was a disaster. And now Libya is the largest home to ISIS outside of Iraq and Syria. We now know, I mean, the New York Times has actually done pretty good reporting on this. They released a long-form two-part piece that was 13,000 words when they were put together. And it details how Clinton took a leading role as Secretary of State. In some ways, she actually played a more important leadership role than Obama, than the president, in pushing for a war against Libya that, you know, was also based on lies. Micah Zenko, an analyst at the Council on Foreign Relations, published an article in Foreign Policy several months ago using NATO's own documents to show that this was a regime change operation from the beginning. It was not about, you know, humanitarian intervention. So I think absolutely, when you look at Clinton's record, any country that's not allied with the U.S. is terrified of a potential Clinton presidency and what it could mean and the wars she could create.
Okay, that's Ben Norton. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we are spending the full hour addressing the election and the so-called Russian threat. We are joined from New York by journalist and writer Ben Norton. He is politics reporter and staff writer at Salon.com. We are also joined from Moscow by Clinton Ehrlich, a visiting researcher at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, and by Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and now political activist and journalist. Clinton Ehrlich, I want to go back to what's the big picture, not just the recent sort of demagogic, absurd, bizarre, and still relentless attacks against Russia for all things bad in America. But I want to talk about how things have evolved, the trajectory of U.S.-Russian relations during the past 7 years that gives us a bigger, broader, long-term picture. When Obama came into office, he said he wanted to press the reset button with Russia. That's when Hillary Clinton was his Secretary of State. Now, of course, one of her first decisions was to name Victoria Nuland to be her spokesperson at the State Department. Victoria Nuland is a neocon. She was Dick Cheney's spokesperson during the Bush administration. And very quickly thereafter, instead of pressing a reset button, meaning a warming of relations, relations started to go downhill. They started going south. Talk about why that happened. Why was it impossible, if Obama wanted to improve relations with Russia, why did that not happen?
Well, first, I would say that Victoria Nuland is actually even worse than that, because she's married to Robert Kagan, one of the architects of the Iraq War, and someone who is quoted in the New York Times bragging that Hillary Clinton is going to pursue a neoconservative foreign policy. I would say that in order to understand what's happened in U.S.-Russia relations, we actually have to go further back to September 11th, because that was the time when it seemed like the United States and Russia were really poised to put away their Cold War differences and focus on a common enemy of Islamic terrorism. And that's something that Russia is all too familiar with. And the fact that there was this horrible new enemy for the United States was in essence a blessing for Russia, or at least it appeared that way, because it seemed that a realist American foreign policy would be one that joined forces with Russia in its new war on terror. And instead, we've seen that America continues to prioritize its Cold War aggression over actually combating terrorism. And that's something that's shocking after September 11th. So shocking that people often don't believe it when I tell them, and that even in the face of leaked Defense Intelligence Agency documents that show an American intent to create an Islamic State in Syria in order to oust Assad, people just cannot wrap their minds around. But it's very clear that the decision makers within the Pentagon and within the State Department care less about stopping terrorism than they do about denying Russia the ability to project power. And that's something that Russia needs to be able to do in order to protect its own interests. It's in Syria because it's trying to combat the very same threat of Islamic terrorism that threatens the United States. And instead of joining forces with Russia, what we're doing is trying to oust Assad and deny Russia its only military base outside the former Soviet Union and a key naval base, which gives it access to the Mediterranean. And the reason I have to go back and disagree with Ray and Ben on Trump, and I say this having talked to some relatively high-level decision-makers within Russia, is that there's a distinction between the rhetoric that Trump uses in the domestic campaign, and Putin has publicly said that he understands that Trump says certain things for domestic consumption, versus the understanding of what kind of foreign policy Trump will actually pursue. And what's so striking about Trump is that he hasn't been wedded to the orthodoxy of the Republican Party, that despite the fact that it's given him no political gain and plenty of political headaches, he's come out and said that it's in our best interest to partner with Russia. His line in all of his speeches is, wouldn't it be great if we got along with Russia? And it may be delivered at a fourth grade level, but it's fundamentally true. Yes, it would be great. It would be phenomenal if the world's two most powerful countries would join forces and pursue their common enemy.
But Clinton, let me just ask you, and I'll ask the other guests too. We'll throw it over to Ray McGovern in a second. I mean, take Russia's foreign policy in the Middle East. Russia wanted the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on Iran. They wanted an Iran nuclear arms deal. They wanted to reduce tension there. Now Trump says that's the worst deal. I'll rip it up on the very first day of a Trump administration. That's not something that Russia could possibly support. And that's not just Trump talking for domestic audiences. He's talking like that's going to be his number one top priority when he comes into office. Talk about it for a second, then I want to bring Ray McGovern right back into that discussion.
I think the beauty of Trump is that he qualifies everything with this claim of negotiations and that he's the world's best dealmaker. And so when we see what Trump says on Iran, first of all, he's constrained because the Iran deal was already so unpopular within the Republican Party that there was no way he could become the nominee while supporting it. But more importantly, he doesn't say that it's possible to actually pull out of the Iran deal. If you look at what Trump actually says, he claims that there's some sort of he's going to find a loophole in the Iran deal. Well, there are no loopholes. And realistically, what will happen is that Trump will negotiate some sort of symbolic modification or change, and that will placate the Republican base that doesn't even actually know what is in the Iran deal.
Let's bring Ray McGovern. Same question, Ray.
Well, Brian, I think you bring up a very good point. The Iran deal, which really prevents Iran from attaining a nuclear weapon, as though they were working on one, which they're not, for 10 years or so. Now, for Trump to say he's going to rip that up, you know, that's serious. Russia's like that, but what kind of guy is this? Well, unpredictability is his force. Give me a break. Now, let's see. Clinton went back to 9/11. I think we really only have to go back 3 years. 3 years ago, the Newlands and the other neocons and John Kerry had us almost at war with Syria. In other words, an almost open invasion, open, at least a missile strike, that's what it would be, from the Mediterranean, shock and awe on Syria. Now, make a long story short, who bailed Obama out? There was a fellow named Vladimir Putin. And how did he do that? He persuaded the Syrians to get all their chemical weapons destroyed. How were they destroyed? On U.S. ships specifically configured for destroying chemical weapons. Do Americans know that? No, they don't know that. Why? Because it's not in the New York Times. Now we're looking at a situation where the Russians and we are trying to peace, at least a cessation of hostilities and possibly even a ceasefire in Syria. We are cooperating on that. The problem is that our, quote, moderate rebels, end quote, are a problem. The Russians are saying to us, look, would you please just give us a map and tell us where your moderate rebels are? And we've not been able to do that. Long story short, the Russians are doing their best to cooperate with us in areas that suit their interests. And let's face it, the terrorism in Syria, just look at the map, huh? Look at the map. Now think about Chechnya. Now think about the 3,000 Chechnyans who have been trained and equipped and are really good terrorists now. Think of when Syria is over. Where are they going to go? They come back to Chechnya. So Putin has skin in this game, and he's not going to let Assad fall. And why does Assad have to fall? It's the last thing I have to say here. You know, Americans are totally oblivious to the fact that our policy towards Syria is the same policy as Israel's. And when asked, the high officials have said our preferred outcome in Syria is no outcome. As long as Shia and Sunni are at each other's throats, not only in Syria, mind you, but in the whole region, Israel has nothing to fear from Syria. We prefer no one to win. Now, how does no one win? Well, look at U.S. policy for the last 5 years, guaranteeing that no one wins because we won't bite the bullet. We won't say to the CIA, look, this was a cockamamie idea. Tell your, quote, moderate rebels to go home. And we won't do that. And John Kerry is not strong enough to face into John Brennan, the head of the CIA, and say, look, Obama, this is really not working. And it's not redounding to anybody's benefit to keep insisting that Assad has to go. Why does Assad have to go? Because Israel would like him to go. And the Saudis, of course, well.
Ben Norton, I want to take the trajectory of U.S.-Russian relations even further back from where we're talking about it. Go back to the end of the Soviet Union. That's 25 years ago. At that time, when the Soviet leadership, first under Gorbachev, and then certainly after the dissolution of the USSR and under the Yeltsin leadership, made it clear that the United States was now a friendly power. The Russians, the Red Army, left Eastern Europe. There was a promise made. There was a promise, both first informal and then formalized, that NATO wouldn't expand east. In other words, the new weakness that Russia was experiencing following the collapse, not only of the USSR, but its closest allies in Eastern and Central Europe, that the United States would not, quote, take advantage and expand into those areas, using NATO as the tip of the spear to make it all part of an American sphere of influence. But that started immediately. It started immediately and relentlessly, and NATO has gone further and further east to the countries that stopped or tried to stop the push east, like Yugoslavia. They were mercilessly destroyed in bombing wars by NATO, another principal ally of Russia just destroyed. Why is it, after the fall of the Soviet Union, after the fact that this Russia is no longer a socialist state or leading a global socialist camp, that the United States cannot have a live and let live attitude with Russia?
Well, I think it's an incredibly important point. And in many ways, we're actually kind of living through this neo-McCarthyite period, which is very strange because, as you mentioned, you know, the Soviet Union imploded 25 years ago, and we still have this kind of rhetoric about, you know, red Russia is attacking the freedom-loving West. In fact, I mean, this is a quick aside, but in fact, Joanne Reed, who's an MSNBC pundit, tweeted the other day about, quote, authoritarian communist Russia. It's like, what decade do you live in? You know, Russia has been a capitalist country for 25 years. It's obscene. But we're seeing much of the same kind of rhetoric. And what it does is it just shuts down people's critical thought process. You know, they know to associate it with these communist boogeymen. and it's the enemy of the U.S. and freedom, et cetera. But, I mean, I think, you know, the point about NATO is incredibly important. I mean, we need to, you know, Stephen Cohen and others have, you know, established scholars have written about this. And it's really rare to hear this perspective in the U.S. media, but we need to think about it from a more impartial perspective and not from the perspective of, you know, the U.S. political establishment. I mean, NATO has a truce buildup on Russia's border. Imagine if Russia or, you know, the non-existent Warsaw Pact or, you know, Russian allies and Russia were teaming up and then putting troops on the U.S.-Canada border or the U.S.-Mexico border. It's really completely imbalanced the way that people talk about it. I mean, you know, as you mentioned, the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia basically destroyed the country. I mean, Yugoslavia was breaking up at the time, but it cemented the, you know, complete dissolution of that alignment. And as you look, you know, in 95, NATO bombed and supposedly helped liberate Bosnia and, you know, modern Bosnia and Herzegovina. But now this is one of the poorest countries in Europe. And, you know, you can also look at the NATO bombing of Libya. So I think, you know, if you look at the history of NATO, if you look at how it's expanded, if you look at what countries like Turkey, another NATO member, are doing, although, I mean, excluding the brief period of rapprochement that we might have recently come to see between Turkey and Russia, we'll see what happens with that. I mean, I just think if you look at NATO's actions for the past several decades, people, you know, who aren't members of NATO, and especially a large power like Russia, has every right to be terrified of its, you know, periodic Eastern encroachment. And the fact that the U.S. sees Russia as this enemy, I mean, is just a part of larger global politics. I mean, to reference your last question, I mean, yes, Russia hasn't been socialist of any sort for 25 years, so the U.S. can't use that excuse anymore, but it's still a large superpower along with China, and it threatens U.S. hegemony over markets. You know, it threatens potential U.S. trading with other countries. It threatens its access to particular markets, Russia, especially Russia's involvement in the petroleum industry and the battle over oil and natural gas. I mean, these are all important economic questions, and China and Russia are the U.S. larger competitors on the, you know, in the global capitalist system. So inevitably, there's going to be some kind of conflict between those countries. So the U.S. no longer has this ideological way to frame its battle, but it's trying to use, you know, remnants of that ideological battle during the Cold War to continue justifying this incredibly aggressive policy.
Clinton Ehrlich, we have just about 2 minutes before we take a short break. Vladimir Putin said, and I'm quoting an article that just came out on Consortium News and also on Ray McGovern's website by Robert Perry. He wrote in an extraordinary op-ed in the New York Times on September 11th, 2013, Putin described the relationship with Obama as one of growing trust while disagreeing with the notion of American exceptionalism in the last section of his op-ed. After he wrote that, one might think, hey, that's just contributing to a discourse, a conversation about that concept of American exceptionalism. Putin was immediately treated as if he had just carried out a military attack against the United States for having even broached the subject that maybe America shouldn't be considered exceptional because it made everybody else feel small. We have 1 minute.
Well, it's funny because Obama essentially had disavowed American exceptionalism in the campaign, saying that he felt that America was exceptional in the same sense that citizens of other states felt that their countries were exceptional. But Putin has a long history of showing that he doesn't think America should stand above and apart from Russia. Actually, back in 2000, Putin indicated that he was open to Russia joining NATO, and that sentiment was certainly strengthened after 9/11. And so it's not so much that America is exceptional in Putin's view, but rather that America is a potential partner. And the fact that even acknowledging the fact that or suggesting that America shouldn't be the hyperpower in the world led to that reaction really shows you, as Ben said, the kind of McCarthyite times that we live in.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today, we are spending the full hour addressing the election and the so-called Russian threat to the American political system. We are joined from New York by journalist and writer Ben Norton. He is politics reporter and staff writer at Salon.com. We're joined from Moscow by Clinton Ehrlich, a visiting researcher at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, and by Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and now political activist and journalist. Before we left, I was mentioning to Clinton about President Putin's op-ed in the New York Times on September 11, 2013. It was a very prescient moment in a time that you were referring to earlier in the show, because the United States was on the verge of bombing Syria, not bombing ISIS in Syria, but bombing the Syrian Arab Army, the Syrian national government. There was a chorus. It seemed inevitable. And suddenly the Obama administration was able to step back from it. Of course, there was grassroots support in England, all over the United States. But also the Russian government came in and offered a face-saving way out by saying, look, we've talked to President Assad. We can get their chemical weapons. We can turn them over to a third party. They can be thus destroyed. In other words, he gave the United States a way out of carrying out what would have been a catastrophic next Middle East war. But then after Putin said America's not exceptional, he's treated by the media as if like he had really made a major attack on the United States. Why is that so important to the mainstream media, to the corporate-owned media in the United States?
Well, because they're all a piece of the neoconservatives. In other words, I had personal experience on the top of the CNN building watching Joe Lieberman and Paul Wolfowitz in black ties, looking as if both their mothers had been just run over by a Mack truck 3 days after Obama said, we're not going to strike Syria now because the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says we can do this anytime and we're going to go to Congress for permission. They were livid. Lieberman ranted and raved and said, look, the president doesn't need congressional permission to start a war. I confronted him on that, but that's another question. Now, let me just comment on some of the things that have been said. Yes, when the Berlin Wall fell, George H.W. Bush promised not to take advantage of it. He convened a summit within 6 weeks, and then he sent Baker to Moscow, where Baker promised, and it's in Baker's notes, not that NATO would not, quote, leapfrog, end quote, over East Germany if we let the Germans reunify. So that was not immediately, but it was under Clinton that NATO started expanding and trust evaporated, okay? I had a chance to talk to a fellow named Kuvaldin, who is now at the university, one of the universities of Moscow, and he was an advisor to Gorbachev. And I said, look, why was that agreement, that promise, not written down? And he said, well, two reasons. I mean, it was a little premature. The Warsaw Pact still existed, and we really needed to get the Germans in on this, right? But mostly, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he says, mostly because we trusted you. Whoa. Now, that's 1990, okay? Now, you fast forward. We have the first Gulf War. Now, we had no fear that the Russians would prevent us. And Wolfowitz told Wesley Clark, a general who used to head up NATO, the chief lesson the U.S. learned from the first Gulf War in 91 was, quote, the Russians won't stop us or can't stop us, end quote. Now, fast forward to 2003, it was still the same. The Russians can't stop us. Now, quite different. The Russians have stopped us. They've stopped us in Syria. Now, going back to your mention of this letter, actually it was an op-ed in the New York Times, and the date was September 11, 2013. Now, Putin, I'm reliably informed, wrote the last paragraph of this op-ed, which you didn't quote yet, so I'll quote some of it. It is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional. The big countries, small countries, rich and poor, those with long democratic traditions and those still finding their way to democracy. Their policies differ too. We're all different. But when we ask for the Lord's blessings, we must not forget that God created us all equal, end quote. Whoa. I think I read that in the Declaration of Independence. Well, you know, we should have accepted that as an olive branch. Hey, we can cooperate on things. But it infuriated the neocons, and it was a catalyst to their hastening their plans to foment a coup on Russia's doorstep in Kiev. You know the rest of that story. That was just what? We're talking September. That was the next February. You do the math. And so now we have Russia having, quote, invaded Ukraine, which they didn't, having invaded Crimea, which they didn't. And now we've got sanctions on them. We blame them for knocking down that MH17 plane over Ukraine. We blame them for all matter of things. Why? Well, look, war, tension, really good for business, Brian. You know that. You know what the corporate media is like. You know what the neocons are like. War is really good for business. Peace, not so much. A lessening of tension with Putin is not really the recipe to sell more arms, and that's the deal that these people are in. And Pope Francis, of all people, was exactly right when he had the guts to stand up before Congress and he said, the main problem is the blood-soaked arms traders, and blood-soaked arms traders look for a really good deal no matter who becomes elected in the next election in November.
Ben Norton, after World War II, the United States reorganized the non-socialist world, what we might call the capitalist world, the world of the former colonial empires. It became the dominant power. It became the indispensable part of that alliance, certainly. NATO, of course, that was begun in 1948, became a way to pull together all of those allies, including the former enemies like Germany during World War II, under a U.S.-led military alliance, a united front where all of them became, in a way, junior partners, where the U.S. was the senior partner. The question that comes to mind is, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, after the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact countries, the mirror parallel force that the Soviets had created in response to or anticipating NATO, after that was gone, why would the United States not have brought or invited Russia into NATO? In other words, why not, if the axis of the struggle was over communism or over the question of the mode of production or the means of production or the ideology of socialism and communism, why not invite Russia into NATO? And one of the things that comes to mind is that would that have then loosened the Western-based post-World War II alliance that the United States had counted on for its own sort of global hegemony? Would Germany, for instance, if Russia was treated as a friend, as part of NATO, as part of a global arrangement, have sort of gravitated in the direction of Russia rather than the United States? In other words, was it a threat to U.S. hegemony to have allowed the tensions to completely diminish?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think when we think about this particular, you know, global problem, it's not unique to just Russia. I mean, I mentioned China. You know, you can talk about the Latin American bloc. You can talk about, you know, the growing power of Brazil and other countries. But I think Russia, you know, as perhaps the second strongest country in the world, maybe the third considering China, I mean, the relation between Russia and the U.S. is probably almost inevitably going to be a sour one. You know, perhaps Russia could align with the U.S. and then China would be the enemy. But I mean, just the way global politics works in a global capitalist system, I mean, just this kind of conflict is inevitable. This is what imperialism is. And we need to talk about it that way. As I mentioned, you know, some of these, you know, extreme right-wing hawks are calling themselves imperialists. They're no longer even, you know, pretending that they're not. So I think we have to use the I word. There's no way to understand it without using the word imperialism. And, well, I mean, I certainly agree with much of the analysis of Ray and Clinton, and I appreciate both their work. I mean, I honestly think the influence of neocons is highly exaggerated. I mean, I think it's important to understand the neocon worldview, and it's one that Clinton, you know, abides by. And, you know, Obama is not a neocon, but he's still an imperialist. And it's about understanding how global politics works in this large system. And Russia is the largest competitor to the U.S., Russia and China, for economic hegemony. And as you mentioned, I mean, NATO was a way that former enemies could unite against a large socialist bloc. But if you look at it today, you know, now that socialist bloc is gone, we've started to see, you know, competition in between former capitalist allies again. So, I mean, the EU is perhaps breaking apart. Brexit might be the first brick that falls from this larger wall. We shall see. But you know, I think we're approaching a time similar to World War One, where, you know, I mean, hopefully we don't actually engage in another kind of war, and if that happens, it'd be far off. I mean, the U.S. is still allied, certainly, with the U.K. and France and other countries. But people forget that, you know, just 100 years ago, before the Russian Revolution, before the rise of socialist powers, the U.S., I mean, and especially the European powers, were fighting among each other. And, you know, now that the world is basically, for the most part, capitalist, I mean, there are a few challenges to this large economic system. We've come back to a period of inter-imperialist competition, essentially. But the thing is, we're coming out of a unipolar world where the U.S. was the uncontested hegemon of the planet. I mean, especially in the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed. For one of the first times in history, the U.S. was perhaps the unrivaled, you know, imperial power that no one else could challenge. So this is a long discussion that, you know, it deserves its own hour. But I think when we're framing this, it's important to understand that I mean, I agree with Clinton, it would be, for global peace, it would be great if, you know, the U.S. and Russia weren't at each other's necks. I mean, that would be a positive thing. And the kind of conflict that creates is bad. We can see this in Syria and elsewhere. But I think that that's not possible in a large global capitalist system, because you have competition between countries for access to capital, for access to markets, for access to natural resources. And, you know, this is just how the global system works. And the U.S. and any other powers that challenge the U.S. are, I think, inevitably enemies.
Clinton, Ehrlich, we're talking about, and I think it's important to talk about, the fact that there can be world wars, because they've happened. There was World War One. That started August 1914. It changed the world. The unmatched, unimaginable, up until that time, violence that was imposed on the world, or big parts of the world, sort of changed the old social order, weakened it, and made it impossible for it to retain any semblance of stability. 20 years later, there was a Second World War. And after the Second World War, there became a certain equilibrium once there were two kind of class camps, one led by the Soviet Union, one led by the United States. Once the Soviet Union achieved military parity and had significant allies, it became an equilibrium that has been now shattered following the collapse or dissolution of the Soviet Union, the attempt by the U.S. to impose a unipolar position on the world. When you wrote your article in Foreign Policy, which is being attacked now for having printed your article, but you said the Kremlin really fears war. Is the Kremlin preparing for war, or is this kind of shadow boxing, or both?
I think that it's a bit of both, that the Kremlin, like the United States, prepares for war constantly because it views that as the most effective way to preserve peace. But it certainly doesn't want war. And one of the things that I've talked about extensively with my colleagues within the Russian Foreign Ministry, and I want to make clear, I don't speak for the Russian government. I'm an American citizen. But one of the things that I've talked about is the fact that we can't count on nuclear deterrence to preserve peace anymore. That the most dangerous time during the Cold War was the period roughly from when Russia detonated its nuclear weapon until the Cuban Missile Crisis, when there was this uncertainty about the nature of nuclear deterrence and how effective it would be. And we're entering a similar period as new technologies come online that are changing the balance of power. Those technologies include not only cyber attacks, but also conventional global strikes, essentially the first conventional strategic weapon that the United States is working on fielding. And it also involves the multi-object kill vehicle, MOKV, that the United States is building, which is clearly targeted at Russia because Russia is the only country that officially fields MIRVs, which are warheads, essentially, or they're missiles that can deliver independently targeted warheads to multiple targets. And we're essentially trying to remove their ability to have that strategic deterrent. And to go back to what Ben said about global civility, it's not my position that we're in a position that we're on the path to world peace, or that's something that's possible, but rather that the United States is not pursuing its own interests, and that realistically, the United States and Russia have the prospect of partnering together. I subscribe to something called power transition theory, and this idea that the United States and Russia are both status quo powers, particularly Russia, that it may sort of imitate the rising powers in the BRICS system, except realistically, it has a greater landmass than any country in the world with a declining population. And so Russia wants to maintain that. China is a rising power. China is a power whose population is growing and that has its eyes on the east of Russia. And so we have this opportunity to restore equilibrium, but it requires recognizing that times have changed and that the new equilibrium, the new balance is one where the United States partners with Russia. And it doesn't mean that China has to be a common enemy.
That's Clinton Ehrlich. Clinton, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have 1 minute left. I want to get Ray McGovern in for the last word. Ben Norton said, you know, it's a global system. It's imperialism. It's inevitable that this will happen. Clinton is also emphasizing, though, that there can be policy changes that could make it somewhat different outcome in terms of how the system, you know, sort of plays out right now in this growing confrontation with Russia. In the last 45 seconds, Ray, what do you think?
Well, Brian, I think that the Kremlin does really fear war. Kremlin planners, especially their military, have to look at capabilities, not intentions. And when they look at Trump and they look at Hillary Clinton, they look at Clinton as openly avowing that the United States is the sole indispensable country in the world. Whoa. Well, that empowers us to do whatever the hell we want. And the problem is we no longer have that capability. The Russians have stopped us in Syria. And the biggest sea change, and Ben is right to point this out, is that whereas before, the Nixon administration was able to play off Russia against China to our advantage, now Russia and China are in the same position, being able to play a game where, let me put it this way, if there are hostilities in Central Europe, I will bet that the Chinese will stir up lots of tension in the South China Sea, and the U.S. will not be able to deal with both. In other words, Russia and China are, in effect, allies.
Okay, we're gonna have to leave it right there. We are completely out of time. That was the voice of Ray McGovern. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.